The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Jason Freeman, and it's my great honor to introduce Ross Gay and Major Jackson tonight. Ross Gay is the author of The Book of Delights, a life-affirming collection of short lyric essays that reminds readers to appreciate so-called ordinary wonders, even during turbulent times. His several volumes of poetry include Catalog of Unabashed Gratitude, winner of the 2015 National Book Critics Circle Award, and the 2016 Kingsley Tufts Poetry Award. B. Holding, winner of the 2021 Pen America Gene Stein Book Award, and Bringing the Shovel Down. A writing professor at Indiana University, he joins us tonight with his latest book, Inciting Joy, Essays, an exploration of the ways that people can inspire love and compassion by recognizing that which unites us. These essays touch upon such topics as the home garden, skateboarding as a means to reclaim public spaces, and the costs of masculinity. Recent guest and U.S. Poet Laureate Ada Limón calls it brilliant. Our other author tonight, Major Jackson, is the Richard Dennis Green and Gold Professor at the University of Vermont, a core faculty member of the Bennington Writing Seminars, and the poetry editor of the Harvard Review. He is the author of 5 books of poetry, including The Absurd Man, Holding Company, and Leaving Saturn. And his work has appeared in The New Yorker, The Paris Review, and Plowshares, among numerous other periodicals and journals. He joins us this evening with A Beat Beyond, Selected Prose of Major Jackson, a decade-spanning collection of essays, interviews, and notes that delve into the intellectual and spiritual aspects of his craft. One review calls it an unrelenting deployment of his critical gaze, revealing with clarity and precision American poetry as a chaotic space brimming with glorious renewal. Join me in welcoming tonight's authors.
Hello, everyone. Hello. It's good to see yous. So I'm reading first. This is Major Jackson. You all know Major. I'm Ross Gay. We're going to read a little bit first, and then we're going to have a conversation, and then have a kind of open Q&A situation. But it's so good to be here. I was saying, I think the last time, not the last time I was in this building, but I think I read here like 25 years ago. It's a little while ago, before some of you were born. It's a weird thing to say, before some of you were born. Hopefully you get to do it too. So I'm going to read a little bit from this book called Inciting Joy. And maybe I'll just read the first 10 minutes of this. We're going to both read about 10 minutes of this essay called Baby. No, not this one. No. No, it's a good start. It's a good start. Never mind. I'm going to do that one. I'm going to do that one. It's called Baby, This Might Be You. And all these essays have like kind of subjects in a way. They're all subjects of joy. And this one is called Laughter, the Sixth Incitement. This might be an obvious one, or seem like it, but not to me. Because like every single thing, I was shown it by someone else. It was given to me. In this case, by my beloved Dave, a.k.a. Tornado, a.k.a. Papa, who one day noted that sometimes when I get laughing, and Dave is the often origin of that laughter, I mean, my God, I love him. I hope you have a friend like Dave. He said I looked like I was dying. I think he said it like this. Sometimes when you laugh, you look like you're dying. And then he imitated my dying. I mean, my dying with laughter. Squinting hard and my mouth wrenched into a grimace and shaking my head no and my hand out into the air and often kind of falling off whatever it is I'm sitting on, a chair or bench, or in Dave's old house where I used to sleep over a lot, on the couch, which I called the dream couch for how intense and marvelous my dreams on it were. He would fall off whatever he was sitting on, arm out, crawl on his hands and knees before collapsing on his stomach like a fish, smiling, which would make me, once again, die with laughter. I think I've heard, for what it's worth, laughter is one of the ways we indicate peaceability. Like, you know, you can let down your guard, let's have some lemonade, etc. But it is also one of the ways, in my experience anyway, we consider our dying. We laugh along with our dying. Or, as Dave puts it in a poem, quote, laughter is our way of letting the universe know we agree with the passage of time. I have a lot of footnotes in this book. Too many footnotes. Here's one. Footnote. And I'm going to say, so laughter is our way of letting the universe know we agree with the passage of time. Footnote. You can tussle with the word agree, and maybe you think it ought to be argue, or refuse, or rage, or tango, all of which are awesome. Now go write your poem. My sweet Aunt Butter, who is 94, please tell no one I told you that, and has chronic lung disease, is, well, usually when you're 94, you are dying more clearly than when you are, say, 24 or 48. She laughed when we talked on the phone recently and told me I needed to get out there to see what it was like getting old like that, which a lot of our people do. I think she meant living long, yes, but she also meant dying long. Her whole generation of siblings is alive at the time of this writing, not anymore. Her whole generation of siblings is alive. The baby is 90, the eldest 98, though the generations below have not fared quite as well. My father died at 58. And his babyest brother at 35, a cousin my age gone, others of us youngers pretty banged up. Aunt Butter coughed, said, I ain't shit, meaning I'm weak, I'm dying. Then she laughed and coughed a little more, then giggled and said, you have to come see this baby, this might be you. A couple nights ago, my partner Stephanie and I were sitting on the porch with some friends, and a beloved community member's death came up, and after this and that, there was some joke, and we were falling out of our chairs laughing. We were a fatherless choir on that porch, all of our dads dead, a couple of them gone in their 50s, a couple of them brutal, elongated, intubated, mechanized hospital deaths. And talking about them, yeah, the sad stuff. But we laughed so hard the squirrels ran off. I can't in good conscience write this stuff we or maybe I was saying, you would stop reading. You would think ill of me. Though it was at the intersection of death and sex. Let's just say that. We got loud. We cried with laughter. Probably a few times all of us looked to be dying. On and on like this. How often our recollections of our friend Don, murdered, includes laughter. My dead grandparents are very funny. When my papa was dying the last time, he died just a few years before his son, my dad. He told the doctors he was 6 feet tall. Although after the approximately oh, my cousin knows that story. that was familiarity. Familiarity. Family. When my papa was dying the last time, he died just a few years before his son, my dad. He told the doctors he was 6 feet tall, although after the approximately 1 million surgeries he'd had keeping his body just barely above the ground, he was maybe 5'2". My mother's father, my grandpa, Virgil, ate cherries like a hyena, quoth his youngest, referring to the bloody juice running down his chin and chest. And that quoting youngest, well, how often does it occur to you that every goddamn body is dying? Mm. And my old man gets us laughing and laughing from the other side. How loud he snored, you could hear him down the street. How much he loved a new toy, dude was a sucker for a gadget. How he swished his wine in his mouth, a la I don't know how to say it, savour, French, S-A-V-E-U-R. Savour. Magazine, thank you. How he would regularly almost choke to death while shouting out a question to Jeopardy with a mouthful of dinner. He was a trivia ringer. Even my mother, whose life got ripped in half when he stepped off, sometimes cackles, sometimes giggles, or, oh, There's an entire book about my mother laughing. I would call it My Mother's Laughter. It's probably from her whom I'm in this way descended, because like me, there are times she laughs so hard she disassembles. She puts her head into her hand and starts gasping. She'll try to talk and she might drool a little. Tears will run down her face. Her voice gets high and wispy. She is in the throes. She is a leaking sack of delight. And though unlike me, her hard laughing doesn't involve striking what is near, sometimes including very hard my own body, usually my heart, she does sometimes sort of hug herself. She looks like she's dying. I'm not sure this joke of my dad's could get her there. Maybe, but it sure as hell did and still does me. Here it is, with a little adornment. Duh, it's a joke. Toby is excited for his first day. I gotta tell you, so I love this joke. My partner's heard it a bunch of times. I loved it the first time I heard it when I was 6 years old, 7 years old. You might not love it.
It's funny. It's very funny.
When my partner heard I was putting this whole joke in the book, she was like, what the fuck are you doing? Like, don't do that. Man. We'll see. We'll see. We'll take a poll. Toby is excited. It's too long. I'm going to have to stop anyway. So. Toby is excited for his first day of kindergarten. After breakfast, his mother takes him to the bus stop. And when the bus pulls up, Toby squeals and runs in place with glee. And when the big doors open up, his mom sets him loose and he climbs the huge steps in, bouncing down the aisle to the open seat. When he gets to his seat, he waves to her from the window. But when he gets off the bus at the end of the day, he's crying. Mom says, Toby, what's wrong? Why are you crying, honey? And Toby says, all the kids at school were calling me Big Head. Mom says, oh, honey, they're just being silly. They don't mean anything by it. She wipes his tears, his frown turns upside down, and she says, now go play, which he does. The next day, same thing. Have a good day, Toby. Thanks, Mom. Up he goes, excited for school again, waving from the window. And a few hours later, out he comes, crying again, this time more emphatic. The whole snotty, stutter breath thing. Honey, honey, what's wrong? Why are you crying? Toby says, Mommy, Mommy, they keep calling me Big Head. He's crying big tears now and kicking his feet in the dirt. Honey, what did I tell you? They don't mean it. Sweetie, listen to me. They don't mean it. They're just kidding around. It's what kids do. She chucks his chin. She chucks his chin. They're probably just jealous of my handsome guy, okay? He settles down. She hugs and kisses him and pats him on the butt. Now go play, which he does. The third day, the same thing. Have a good day, Toby. Up he goes, excited for school again, waving from the window. And a few hours later, out he comes, crying again, this time inconsolable, full body shudders. Shoulders and chest quaking, a snot storm, mouth wrenched in pain. Honey, honey, what's wrong? It's kind of funny. You'd think by now she'd know what's wrong. So you need three for the joke. Honey, honey, what's wrong? Why are you crying? Toby says, Mommy, Mommy, they keep calling me Big Head. The tears are enormous. They make little puddles in the dirt where he's kicking his feet. Honey, what did I tell you? They don't mean it. It's not true. He keeps crying hard, and she says, oh, honey, come here. And this part is acted out. Wipe your eyes. Blow your nose. In my 7 years on Earth, I had never experienced anything funnier. In fact, in my 48 years on Earth, there is as funny, but nothing funnier. I remember falling on the ground laughing as my dad looked down at me from his chair with what I now know is a subtly proud, one of the versions of happiness, face. I was rolling around in pain. I could barely catch my breath. It was so funny. Oh, he really had a big head. If you looked closely, you could see with each gasp a tether being cinched between us tighter. And about 15 years later, I was going on a date with someone. I guess she came by my folks' place to pick me up. She was a kindergarten teacher in training. And when she introduced herself to my dad and told him so, he said, oh, when my little cousin first went to school. My brother, who was sitting on the couch reading the Bucks County Courier Times, crumpled the paper in his lap and rolled off the couch. I was standing in the dining room and I collapsed to my hands and knees. It had been 15 years, and though he never got the joke out because we drowned him with laughter, and my date was confused, he killed us. His timing was impeccable. Yeah. I'll stop there.
Good evening, everyone.
Evening.
Let me just say, what a great pleasure, truly, truly great pleasure. When I was invited here, I realized, to read with Ross, I realized, A, it was inevitable. Ross and I have been crisscrossing for a very long time, and we both have roots here in Philadelphia, so I'm really excited. But I had to figure out the timing. A week ago, I was inducted into Central High School's Hall of Fame, and I want to shout out my fellow Lancers who are here. But I had to figure out what I was going to do in between that time, a week ago, Wednesday, and today. And it's been really fantastic. Even though that was amazing, this is the moment that I most look forward to. So I'm very happy to talk to Ross. Of course, have a lot of roots here. I still dream about Philadelphia. Philadelphia finds its way into my subconscious in very fascinating ways, the most recent being the old bulletin building on Broad Street at a dream of my family and I fixing the clock up there. That was the most recent. But it's part of the DNA, and there's great friends who are here. I'm so happy to see you all. I was going to read, I'll tell you a little about A Beat Beyond, which is, I've had the privilege of learning about the art of poetry by, of course, teaching, but also writing about it. And the writing has emerged first, I would say, as little reviews here and there in the Philadelphia City Paper, who were foolish enough to give me a column, a hip-hop column. It's too bad that that independent paper is gone, because it's really fantastic. A lot of writers came into their own through that publication. I was one of them. This book also collects lectures from the many institutions that I've taught, podcasts, blogs, you name it. I just threw it all in there. One of my earliest pieces was a piece about a little-known group called The Roots. And this was right when they first started performing on the streets. And I'll read that one. If I have time, I will read a piece that Ross found particularly funny. In fact, I'm going to start with that because he just laughed. Yeah. And it's probably timely right now because it's taking up this question of cultural appropriation. How do we address issues that may not emerge from our own particular culture's struggle? And at the time that I wrote this, a very well-known poet had instigated a conversation, at least initially among friends, around white folk writing about race. And the person that she pointed to had many different failures, but in the end, in this essay, I applauded it. And now, very controversially, this is a conversation that we are having today. So this was written in 2007. There is a limit to our empathy. Do we really possess an appetite for nuanced representations of racial attitudes and experiences in our poetry for the purpose of cultivating compassion in our nation? There is a disturbing and relative silence in American poetry that refuses to be filled by the majority of white American poets. Needless to say, pages written by Black, Latinx, Native, and Asian American poets do great service. Well, it's not like people of color have a choice, do they?
especially if they are being true to themselves, as we're told, and writing their lives. All else is manufacture. Over the centuries, many American poets of various ethnicities, from Rita Dove to Jessica Hagedorn, from Aga Shahed Ali to Sherman Alexie, have deemed it aesthetically fertile, socially and politically relevant even, to portray fraught and enlightening encounters of ethnic difference, to explore joyful nuances of the color line, while white poets have been more reluctant to address the subject with veracity and candor. Why? I posed this question to many white American poets over the past year. In their own voices, some responses included not wanting to cause discomfort in the reader, highlighting poetry's entertainment value in the age of Billy Collins. Others point to a lack of encounter and experience with non-white peoples, feeling they would not authoritatively contribute much in discussion of race relations. In an era of confession, some believe writing about race is opportunistic and disingenuous, for it is not a white issue, but an issue for black people and other people of color. While others fear embarrassment and the negative reaction of friends and strangers, once again, envisioning a liberal-minded and retributive readership that would conduct a virtual public lynching, one person said, or a poeticized truth and reconciliation trial. As stated earlier, the presence of a perceived hypercritical audience actually imperils well-meaning people from fervently expressing with candor their true feelings and opinions. A friend who is an executive director of a nonprofit organization noticed the willingness of her board members to discuss openly questions of race. But once a Latino man joined the board, the chatty trustees suddenly felt stifled and unable to freely argue and debate for fear of being erroneously accused of possessing racist views. I will add another reason. Perhaps the complexities of race in the 21st century far outreach our imaginative capabilities. Another friend, who is a Foreign Service officer in the State Department, called me up with an experience she felt I should write about. Do you have friends that do that? It's great. You write about it. This is what happened. Having entered a hired car after work in Washington, D.C., where she was learning to speak Urdu in preparation for her next tour of duty, she happily put her new language acquisition to work by asking the driver, who had been speaking on his cell phone, from what region of South Asia did he immigrate. Exuberantly, the man responded his native country and was quite pleased that this young black woman from Louisiana could converse in his native tongue. Language brought them together. He praised her for her clarity and diction and reported that his elderly mother was quite lonely in this country and wondered if she had time, would she consider visiting her for an hour in the evenings while he drove his taxi. That way, she could further her proficiency in speaking Urdu prior to her departure overseas, and his mother would be a little less lonely. He would pay her. Then, at a stoplight in the far right lane of a busy intersection in which the light was green and her new friend was unable to turn due to heavy traffic, a taxi driver honked and honked behind them. Suddenly, the irritated taxi driver, who looked to be from West Africa, pulled alongside them and yelled, "N-word, go back where you come from." Her new friend shouted back as he was turning the car, "N-word, you go back where you came from." They sat and spoke not another word in English or Urdu the remainder of the taxi ride. I've been talking poetry for 7 days. So I'm my co-editor, Amor Coley, I want to give shout outs to him, really strongly encouraged me to keep the early writings about music in this volume, mainly to draw the connection which he saw, which was how my deep passion for music informed my aesthetics. This is from the liner notes of the Roots' first album with David Geffen Records. They had another one that was self-produced called Do You Want More? It's a hot, lazy Sunday afternoon. I'm trekking hurriedly up South Street to visit a friend living in the Queen Village area of Philadelphia. On this day, the overwhelming number of Sunday strollers agitate my brisk gait. My tender shoulders take a bruising from the tourists brushing up against me. Bumping like cars on I-95 during rush hour, high fashion garments on display in the windows of French Connection, Gap, and Neo Deco serve as traffic lights. Feeling pressed to quicken my journey, I strategize the best route to my destination. I'll dip to the left, jump out in front of the middle-aged, gaunt-looking man selling roses, run sideways between the old woman and her husband, drop the beggar a quarter, step over the group of slackers squatting and smoking a quickly deteriorating lifestyle. I'm midway through my execution before my eyes catch a side glimpse of the tourists and young bohemians forming a huge circle on the other side of the street. Maybe it's a juggler, a magician, or a comedian. Like most writers, I'm curious. After doing a few cars, elbowing and wedging myself between two tall women, half listening, half admiring, my sun-weary eyes focus on three young men occupying the human circle, a bass player, drummer, and a lyricist. Among the throng of tourists oohing and aahing stand a group of young hip-hop artists anxiously awaiting their turn to display. My tall, thin neighbor sporting fro, beads, Indian print, baggy pants. I don't know why I was obsessed with fashion back then. I'm noticing that. Sandals and a complexion, as we said back in the day, bespeaking Africa, must have been reading my mind. In an entranced, emphatic tone, she whispered, "That's Tariq kicking the lyrics, Amir dribbling over the drums. And that white kid on bass, that's Josh Abrams. They're the Roots." I slip her a quiet, "Oh, word," satisfied at finally caught glimpse of the buzz that's been plaguing Philly's underground hip-hop community. For the past month, I've been hearing much about this trio of organic, homegrown street performers enthralling multiracial audiences with buckets, bass lines, and raw hip-hop. Tariq Trotter, AKA Black Thought, is in the middle, holding a face cloth, black hands in the air, his left tackle frame moving in unison with the inflections of his penetrating words, dropping verbal flow, bad simile, dropping verbal flow with the ease of a faucet. Tariq calls. Tariq calls on all perpetrators to step with effect, playing his lyrical game like a master chess player. Amir Thompson, AKA Question, later called Questlove, is looking off out into the audience, digging faces, peeping reactions, all the while concentrating on the next break. He's a band leader keeping in tune with his musicians as well as the audience. Blam, Josh Abrams, AKA Rubber Band Man, like a cool 50s bassist, closes his eyes, gets into the bass line, and hangs there. All seem to suspend in time in that hot summer sun. Checking them out, I remember not too long ago, some of my boys were chased off this very strip for disturbing the peace with their boom blasters, cardboard boxes, and urban moves that awed and deterred tourists to the dismay of store owners. I also remember my grandfather informing me that South Street was once a repository of black culture. You could catch hoofers like LaVon Robinson tap dancing in front of the historic Royal Theater. Now, 10 years later, here were the Roots reclaiming space with modern expressivity. This is where the voyage begins, all three musicians sweating under the sun's nurturing gaze on South Street. Thank you.
Beautiful.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. How should we start? What do you want to do?
Well, I wanted to, I'm happy you mentioned, you read that particular section. It reminded me of a Sterling Brown poem. I'm not sure if you know this poem. It's a Sterling Brown who taught at Howard, wrote many wonderful poems that were satirical. I just broke my glasses. Yeah. But you know what's funny? Because I rented a car and been driving, I decided to get my second pair.
Whoa.
Right? That's so weird. Maybe I knew that was going to happen. He has this poem, and he was full of satire, very funny, but he has this poem about Slim in Atlanta, is called. And there's a law that is passed that black folk can't laugh. Mm. And if they do laugh, they have to go into what looks like a old school telephone booth. Uh-huh. And so Slim decides just, you know, just to like mess with people, go in and not come out. And people are lining up because they got to get out this particular laughter. And he just stays in there. And people are like in pain because they can't hold it in. I thought of that when I read your piece. But what I admire about that piece, if you take pictures that I've collected and maybe you've collected of friends and family while they're laughing, it's one of the most beautiful images because you can see that embrace of life, what you articulated as being comfortable with time passing. I'm just curious if any of that resonates with you.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And then the preciousness in part is, it's precious. We understand that. And probably the preciousness in part is because, you know, like things are precious when we know that they are fleeting.
Mm.
But the other thing is that the thing that makes laughter dangerous and why probably Slim had to go in the phone booth is because it's contagious.
It's infectious.
It's a vector. And the thing that it does, contagion, this particular contagion reminds us, like contagion does, that we're connected to one another. And so you get enough people. You know, it's why, like, if you played on the football team and you all just started laughing, like, you'd get in trouble. Or when you're in class and you start laughing. Or probably if you're in church or something. You shouldn't laugh in church.
Yeah, right.
You know,
right,
you get thrown out.
Right.
But partly because, you know, I think among the things that laughter does, in addition to, like, you know, actually demonstrating who are true sort of who we're actually connected to,
mm-hmm.
you know, not the hierarchy, not the authority, but in fact each other. Mm-hmm. I think it it also can spin quickly out of control.
You in that chapter, you also talk about how it can also be subversive in certain spaces. Like if that laughter becomes so infectious, everyone's laughing in workspaces that looks like the work isn't getting done.
Yeah, exactly. It's like the real work gets done.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. So could you talk about, first of all, I mean, because we both actually write about music. When you were reading that, what year was that that Roots piece?
That would have been probably 94, 95.
Oh, a little while before leaving Santa.
Yeah, before they even signed. In fact, I was doing research for this book because I also wrote an open letter to them shortly after their celebratory concert in which a little-known group opened for them, the Fugees. And that next year, their album dropped, and it was, like, ridiculous. But I wrote an open letter to them in the Philadelphia City Paper, and I came here to find it, and I couldn't find it in the archives.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
So that, like, sort of early, do you have a sense of how that early music writing informed, or two things maybe, your early music writing, but also early writing in a more public venue, you know?
Yeah, I felt like it was such a privilege, and I thought, do they know what they're doing? Like, I had only written little pieces for school essays requirements. What it did do for me was made me conscious and aware of a readership.
Yeah.
And I had only had, you know, my teachers as readers prior to then. And at work, some of you know, I went to Temple University and took accounting and business school, so there was business writing. So you do think about audience, you do think about your work being consumed in this functional space.
Yeah.
But I love which you do very well. Mm-hmm. The essay lends itself, as you talked about in the Book of Delights, mm-hmm. this kind of it's an exploratory form that allows for a width and expansion of thinking around a particular topic or thought, so that you're writing your way into clarity where we often don't begin.
Yeah. And do you feel like that has, how do you feel like that has informed your poems?
And maybe, too, I'm thinking about,
because you're also like, you're very interested in your poems and sort of formal. You mm-hmm. know, you have a lot of formal dexterity in your poems. And writing in terms of rima sometimes, or like, you know, these sort of linked poems, you know, where you can also go for a long time.
Yeah.
So I'm sort of curious about even did you learn things? Clearly you did, but what maybe are some of the things that you learned about form while writing in these different genres?
Yeah. I remember being in the studio once with The Roots, and it's funny. Their first album was called Organics.
Yeah.
And there was this, the rhythm section got down and was kind of taped. And then there was this kind of the beats there, but then there was this flow that happened in between that was utterly improvisatory. Mm. And for me, you and I both know that to write a poem is to create the conditions by which that energy, that lyricism can kind of happen.
Yeah.
So for me, you know, I was very devoted to the idea that if somehow I can create a structure, like, let's obviously take a sonnet, or I do a lot of rhyming quatrains, mm-hmm. that I could create a music by which all manner of thinking could be facilitated through that. A lot of people see rhyme and meter as constraints, and for me it was utterly the thing that put the fire underneath me and opened doors. And listening, writing about music really forces you to listen. Your piece, it's interesting, I finally reached the end, and the whole time of Inciting Joy I was thinking about gift and gifting and your work as this in a time, of course, in which we are needing voices that kind of connect beyond the normal places that we go. And I was thinking about that Lewis Hyde book, The Gift, and thinking about gift economy. But you address it at the end, and one of the places you land is on the recording of, speaking of music, the recording of Aretha Franklin and that movie.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if you could maybe contextualize the role of music in your own. And by the way, I'm just letting y'all know at the end, me and Ross are gonna sing DeBarge. Love. Just letting y'all know. Like I said, when you hit upon some of his like references, and I was like, love me in a special way. What more can I say? Just love.
Did you hear? Did you hear the one that he just put out? Like not just like last winter or something in February of 2021. It's going around. You should see it.
Okay.
His voice is the same.
He's
like 60 years old. His voice is the same. You know.
Wow.
Oh my, so beautiful.
Yeah.
What was the question?
Music in your life, since we're talking
about.
Because you name check a lot. You even went up to like Dave Chappelle's Block Party.
Oh God, I love that movie so much.
Yeah.
I think there's well, one thing that is interesting, and I bet we maybe share this, is that I don't know. I didn't read as a kid. You know, I read when I was a little kid, and then I read comic books, and then I started reading when I got to college. But I was deeply, you know, I always say that, I should say, I was reading lyrics hard. You know, I was reading lyrics so hard, and I tell this story periodically because I think it's a really good story, and I think it's a nice story actually for young people or for people who have young people in their lives who don't read. And you care about that, whatever. Mm. Which, you know, you don't have to. There's a lot of things to do. But like skateboard, you know? Are they skateboarding? Are you worried about that? But I remember listening to Earth, Wind & Fire. When I was little, I got into Earth, Wind & Fire. And, you know, I think my dad was more of a Commodores man, but he liked Earth, Wind & Fire, too. And right. He was pumped on that. And I, from the Columbia Record Company, yep. You know that little thing?
Yep.
And so it was The Greatest Hits was my first record, and then I just stayed deep with Earth, Wind & Fire. And, you know, I have a book called Catalog of Unabashed Gratitude, and there's a Earth, Wind & Fire record called Gratitude. And anyway, very important. But I remember my dad, our folks had the, you know, the old good headphones that were over my ears. So you couldn't hear real good, but I could hear just a little bit of my folks talking once when I was listening to a record quietly and they were watching the TV. And I could hear my dad say to my mother as I was reading these lyrics, at least he's reading something.
Oh, wow.
And it took me, you know, 30 years and to like hear that. But then I hear it and I'm like, oh, I was so deep in language, you know, like whether it was Tracy Chapman or whether it was Earth, Wind & Fire or Simon and Garfunkel or Public Enemy is, you know, very important to me. And De La Soul, like on and on and on, that I was like studying language in a hard way. So that's, I would say that, it's sort of like formative in the first place. But then the second, and you know, and I love music, but there is also something about, and I don't know exactly about how this is, there's something, I had a conversation like a couple nights ago with Simone White, and we were talking about, she was asking about this moment in this book where I'm comparing Luther, the look on Dionne Warwick's face.
Yes.
In, at the 1988 NAACP Award, 1988, I think, NAACP Awards, where Luther Vandross is covering her song, A House Is Not a Home. And she makes this face, because it's really beautiful. It's really beautiful, the performance. And she makes this face, and I say that the face is this, this motherfucker.
Yep.
And I say it's the same exact face as Gary Payton, the great defensive guard for the Seattle Supersonics, makes when this kid named Jason Williams, a.k.a. White Chocolate, makes an incredible move and just like freezes him, shakes him. And Gary Payton makes his face of like, this motherfucker. And I sort of make this analogous face. But one of the things that I sort of think is that one of the things about music that I love so much, or I go to it so much, is because there's so much to sort of describe.
Mm.
So I can find myself like describing the sounds. I can find myself like comparing the sounds to other things. Mm-hmm. If I can look at them performing, I can describe their bodies in the process of performing, which is one, it's like to another subject, it's sort of like looking at sport, you know? But it also in some way, because music is such, you know, it's absolutely embodied, it feels in some way like the way that poems are made of breaths. Breaths, we only get a limited amount of them. Mm-hmm. Poems are also bodies, you know? So that's kind of a way that I would think.
Well, one of the faces you describe, again, in that documentary, is the look of Reverend James Cleveland when Aretha goes in on Amazing.
Yeah.
You could feel the chills in that room that day.
Yeah.
Do you remember this? Who's sitting in the back? Who's standing in the back?
The Stones.
The Stones
are back. Mick Jagger.
Mick Jagger is in the back. Yeah. Getting blessed.
Yeah, they're getting blessed.
Like, getting blessed. Exactly.
Amazing.
Taking notes.
Yes, they're taking notes. Oh, my God. Who among you have seen the Amazing Grace documentary? Oh, it's a. We should stop this right now and play. It's like, it's really.
Just that clip.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
The clip that Major's describing is there's this moment where, you know, James, this is during the, it's two nights. It's the 1972, I think, recording or 71 recording of Amazing Grace, her live gospel album, which I think is still the best selling gospel album of all time. And she is singing Amazing Grace and she's just going and the Reverend, who's kind of the MC of the event and like playing piano and singing also, James Cleveland, he has to take a break. He has to rest, like recover. And he's like having an experience. And then they rest, and then Aretha gets back to her feet, brought up by the choir, basically. And she starts singing, and she goes so far, and the Reverend James Cleveland comes, and you see by incredible moment of like blessed footage. He's holding her dress in the back, holding her. And it's like he's holding her up. And then you see that she's holding his hand. Mm. Like she's holding him up, you know? It's the most beautiful bit of footage.
I was really thrilled that you described that moment. And there's other moments that you described. But one of my great pleasures in your work, and then we're going to ask questions, but one of my great pleasures in your work, Ross, is, yes, the sensibility of a poet, and there's an expansiveness, and there's, you do this kind of associative logic thing, but you always come back to the subject at hand.
Yeah.
That feels to me like the lyric moment inside your poems that kind of leave me quite breathless. And I'm thinking about, just to throw it back at you, how has your prose been informed by your writing poems? Because we know you from some very succinct, I mean, you have big poems the South Street Fig Tree, but you have these wonderful poems, succinct, that just leave us breathless. Yeah.
And here maybe is like a quick way for us to kind of like link up again before, we're both very inspired by, I think is the word, the poet Gerald Stern.
Yes.
He means a lot to both
of us.
You know?
That's right.
And Gerald Stern is this poet, if you don't know his work, you know, beautiful poet. Lived in Philly for a while too, you know, Pittsburgh originally in Philly, Easton a little bit. But he is an amazing poet who writes profoundly intimate, ecstatic, compassionate poems that are also really digressive.
Mm-hmm.
And he also writes... he started writing essays, you know, later in his life. I mean, I think he was probably writing them in his 60s and stuff, but he started writing, had a few books of essays in his after he turned 80, which is exciting. And he writes short essays. And so I think, one, I want to say that I don't know that I would have known it was a possible thing without Gerald Stern, you know.
Yeah.
And then when I go back and read those essays, particularly the last two books, which are short essays, they're short, meditative, funny, ironic, irreverent. I'm like, this is not only the permission, this is sort of like the structure for how I think an essay can work. Mm-hmm. You know, he's like a great teacher. Could you just say a thing about why you love Jerry Stern for a second?
Jerry is the poet who, just last year, some friends and I, he's probably 120 now.
That was like, yeah, he's 97.
He's like, we think about him often, and one time my friend Matthew Dickman and I were sitting at the table. He was like, let's call Jerry. Mm. And you just want to hear his voice. Yeah. That's how much he means to us. But he was the poet I turned to. Speaking of music, as you know, he will repeat a line like the anaphora before we even knew what that word was.
Right. That's right.
I went to Jerry and learned that from him. And it's something about repetition, as Prince says, repetition is joy.
Yeah.
And you can feel that joy in his work as he's at once, it's almost like cataloging the world around him, and it emerges as a litany. Mm-hmm. He has this great sensibility about cities and places and people, trees, the earth. He names it, and he's so informed. He almost turned, he definitely turned my gaze from one of being, you know, as a activist student at Temple University, one in which my poems were kind of outward and kind of occupying that space of taking up space and loudly.
Yeah.
He's the person that had me realize change is when you start looking inward and then having this this relationship, the world around you in which you're expressing gratitude.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's the act.
Yeah.
That's the act.
Thank you. That's beautiful. Other questions? I think it's good to applaud the first person to ask a question.
Okay, so you guys have been talking a lot about like music and like what kind of stuff influenced you. What would you say is the biggest musical influence that like wouldn't sound to like anybody else as something to influence any sort of like art? Like what's like the most random like musician that like kind of sounds crazy to somebody else but like means something to you?
I love that question.
know. Like, I get inspired by, like, Bikini Kill. So, like...
What'd you say?
I said I get inspired by, like, Bikini Kill.
Yeah.
So...
Yeah.
Edie Brickell? Did I miss that? I miss her?
They said Bikini Kill.
Oh,
bikini
got it.
Kill. Yeah, bikini yeah, Kill.
Yeah. Like, Edie Brickell. Okay. All right. That's very literary.
I don't know who that is. Thanks, though. I don't know who that is, but
I know.
That's generational. Yeah, that's generational.
Okay. Yeah.
Don't worry. That is such a great question. It's such a hard question to answer, I think.
Well, a radical thing happened to me as a kid, and that was attending something I'm trying to write about is the Philadelphia Art Museum. I'm gonna get to music in a second, but the work of Duchamp, the Surrealist, and the Dadaists really politicized how I took in art. And and so by the time, like, my friends, we were discussing minimalist composers like Philip Glass and...
Steve Reich.
Steve Reich, yeah. Thank you. And John Cage. To them, it was noise, but I contextualized it in this larger aim of resistance and this imperative to kind of truly hear within a dissonance the possibility of forwarding an art or forwarding a people, or how can I embrace what comes to me as something that gets belittled. And that has been really, really helpful for me. I just happened to ironically purchase the house of one of those individuals. And thank you. And the real estate agent, you know, I'm walking around, I was like, does this person really like own the home? And he's like, you know, and this is like a Vermonter who, you know, that. He's like, what kind of music is it? And I'm like, it's an acquired taste. You know, it's not, some people wouldn't even call it music. So anything that sounds dissonant. And for me, my grandfather introduced me to jazz, which certain friends of mine hear as dissonance. But man, it's that has been really important to me. And I'm talking my way into an answer. 1950s, 60s jazz. Mm.
That question is so good because I don't think I have one. And in part because I'm like, anything that I would listen to would automatically be like, that's worthy of like, like I do know, like in this book, I have an essay about skateboarding. And I feel like I go in on skateboarding in a way that there are going to be people who are like, I'm not following you. I'm not going to go through it, you know. Or I really don't. That's really not my experience. But the music, that question is gonna, you know, trouble me in a great way for a long time.
Nice.
but I do want to say this. There's a book by someone named Samantha Hunt. It's called The Unfinished Novel, or something. I forget what it's called. It's so good. It's her new book, and she writes at length about the group One Direction. Is that it? Yes, but was that is that a face of affirmation or a face of hate? Affirmation, yeah. Okay, aww. Okay. Yeah. Aww. But to me, I was like, how could you write about One Direction? Now I know. I'm sorry. But it's amazing. It's so good because it's in a way, like in that case, like, you know, like a lot of times writers think they're supposed to write like about serious stuff, and One Direction can't be serious. It's so goddamn serious. It's so beautiful. So that's an awesome question.
Is there another question?
I have a question around, I'm extremely not a poet, but both of you have a lot of important poems to me, I think, about placemaking. Your poem about McGlinchey's, I read a lot in the first part of the pandemic for whatever reason. And then your poem, I think, Ninth and Christian with the fig tree. Mm. And I'm wondering if you can speak to like placemaking in Philadelphia in how that shows up in your poetry.
Mm. Wow, that's great. I started writing my first book while on fellowship here in Philadelphia, in earnest, and it was wildly debilitating because I was walking the streets at the same time, and like a reporter, you know, taking notes, like, oh, you know. Yeah. And then I went to graduate school out in Oregon, and my imagination had to do the work of collapsing the distance. And as a result, there was a filtering and selection process that happened. Not intentionally to rep Philadelphia, but it was, Philadelphia gave me so much as a young artist, a young writer, and someone who had great difficulty in my life. And so that was the ground in which I knew, much like Seamus Heaney says in his poem, Digging, that's where I knew I had to kind of drop this shovel first. There are people here. Where's Larry Robin of Robin Bookstore? Was somebody who did a lot of programming to bring in writers who kind of widened my experience. So it's beloved, and that launched me into a practice of paying attention to wherever I live. So there's now, it was hard at first, but I couldn't write about New England, Northern New England, particularly Vermont, even though it excited all of my senses, out of loyalty to this project of writing about Philadelphia. I just did not want to be grouped with Robert Frost. But after almost 20 years.
Yeah.
And there's people who we lost that we mutually lost. And to some extent, your work becomes a continuation of their light and their beauty and their imagination and practice and gifts.
Yeah. That I feel a couple ways about that. Sometimes I feel that same way, where that distance from a place, or like some ability to actually sort of go to the place in the imagination as much as a physical place, can be useful. But I also, like, right now I write a lot about my the garden that I tend. And there's something that's so satisfying as a practice to trying to witness as hard as you can, to notice as closely as you can these processes which you will never notice the end of, you know, which you can never completely notice. And I feel like it can happen at the corner of 9th and Christian, at the fig tree. It's a good place to have a noticing. And it can happen in a garden, and it can happen in a conversation in an airplane, you know. So in a way, I sort of feel like I mean, I'm curious about your question. I love your question, in part because it sort of raises the question of, like, how do you make a place? You know, how do you make a place that exists outside of the place itself? You know what I mean? And to me, the thing that really, like, if Jerry Stern, again, writing about Pittsburgh or writing about Philly, he's writing about it with such kind of specificity and a kind of thing there. If you've gone by that place, you're gonna be like, oh yeah, I noticed that. You know, that was really the place, you know? Yeah.
Speaking of Igar, one of my favorite images of you is in an airplane holding that little tomato plant. Just wanted, for the record, get that out there. Another question.
Hello.
Hi.
I really appreciated what you were saying earlier about both music lyrics and poetry being this embodied process, right? Poetry living in the breaths, and you only have so many breaths, and poetry is made of bodies. Because this is an evening about prose, I'm curious how prose compares to music and poetry in that embodiment for each of you. Like, is prose disembodied? Is it all head? Is there a way that it gets animated with the breath? What happens?
Yeah, I was wondering about that too, like, because I was reading this book, and I was thinking, some of those moments in the essays, I'm like, he's a poet. He's really a poet. And you know, and I don't, and I'm not someone who like elevates the poet over the prose writer, yeah, over the whatever. But there are habits that we have, and sometimes, and there was some kind of, it was actually a kind of cataloging that you were doing at the, it was a kind of an address, and it seemed like it was an address in 2017. I could find it, but there was a moment that made me think, oh, I wonder, like, what is this experience of, because you often write about writing, you often, mm-hmm, write about poetry, but there's also a way in the poetry that it's very clear that you're not only writing about poetry, you're writing as a poet.
Mm. You know what I mean? Thank you. It's going to be a mutual admiration society in a moment. I was trying to find, Ross gets into this, you must have some preachers in your back there somewhere, because Ross will get going on a catalog, and everything that follows that catalog is just pure truth, and it builds on the previous truth, which takes me to your question, which is there's a way in which you approach the sentence as a form of a line of music in itself. Hmm. And that's embedded in the syntax. And sometimes you know, that's very teachable, but it's one of those things that you learn, you forget, and then you come back to the sentence with a great facility. And I think part of the reason why, and I was gonna ask you this, there's so many, this is the great renaissance of poets writing prose. Yeah. And it has to do with their attention to first the line and then this longer constructed prose paragraph that feels like a mini prose poem, you know? And it really does have to do with, I'm saying the line, but language itself. I mean, it's just textured musical notes in a real way, even outside of its meaning. We're just playing the chords, as they say.
Yeah, that's a thing that... And I sometimes, there are moments when I'm writing prose I'm very aware that I'm honoring the music of the thing as much as I'm honoring the meaning. Or a better way of saying it is that I'm believing that the meaning is in the music. And that's a thing that, in prose, it maybe is a little bit of a different gamble than it is with poems. Because I think in poems, we're ready to sort of go with that. And there are moments in some of my essays where I'll be like, I might be the only one who gets that. But it's still, you know, still sort of a pleasure. But I feel like that thing of, a lot of the folks who are writing poems but are also writing essays these days, you can see, you know, like there's an essayist named Brian Blanchfield who's... who's also a poet, whose syntax is just like, you know, I recommend his work. It's called Proxies. It's fucking amazing. Mm-hmm. It's just like so knotty, so beautiful, you know. And there's a lot of folks who you're like, oh yeah, like your language is filling the mouth, you know. And it's, if you like that, then you'll like it. Yeah, yeah.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.